partakes of the powers of the One through the succession of philosophy and discrimination. The beautiful becomes music, which partakes of the primal beauty through the succession of theology and concentration. The good becomes astronomy, which partakes of the original good through the succession of science and observation. Thus is demonstrated the soundness of the ancient Pythagorean doctrine that the establishment and relationship of triads is the true basis of philosophic procedure. If the diagram be considered from the standpoint of the Socratic school, we have an invaluable key to the unfold manner of the inner nature. Socrates affirmed the possibility of stimuli aiding the superphysical nature by familiarizing the objective nature with those tangible arts and sciences that had their correspondences in the superphysical. For example, the study of astronomy increased the power of observation. Through its development, observation in turn produced the scientist, and the scientist plying his scientific pursuits ultimately achieved to a knowledge of the good. Thus unfoldment of the inferior stimulated unfoldment of its analogy in the superior, and step by step in such indirect fashion the highest was ultimately attained. A question frequently asked by metaphysical students is how it is possible to stimulate the spiritual nature, and herein will be found the answer. Each part of the objective nature manifests some potentiality of the subjective life principle. The refinement and perfection of any part of the objective nature is a direct stimulus to its correspondence in the causal nature from which it was originally objectified. Thus the physical activity of thinking, when properly directionalized, develops the entire mental nature or body. Similarly, the proper direction alization of physical emotion results in the unfoldment of the emotional body, which, being invisible and intangible, can only be contacted through its pole in the outer nature. Even Twilly man will be able to definitely relate all his physical parts and members with their incorporeal causal agencies. He can then at will stimulate his superphysical organisms through right directionalization of their corresponding physical organisms. 142 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. The Disciplines of Salvation. 143. The purpose of this chapter is to give a brief outline of what constitutes a rational beginning of the philosophic life. He who would achieve to the highest must realize that without the systematic culture of the entire organism, even a relative degree of perfection is unattainable. The general meta physical practice of platitudes, affirmations, and denials is unsound in theory and barren of results, for the organization of the life is only possible through certain definite, exact, and unchanging disciplines that have been preserved to the present generation as the priceless heritage of antiquity. Many people possess to varying degrees so-called psychic powers. Such powers may be considered as natural to them. In other words, they have not been acquired by any definite effort. But regardless of how remarkable these natural endowments may seem to both their possessor and the world at large, they are a liability rather than an asset unless they are reduced to order through philosophic discipline. Nearly all so-called natural mystics have missed the goal for which they strove, because they were satisfied to accept intangibles and indefinite attitudes as the lodestar of life. With few exceptions, such natural psychics conceive themselves to be very highly evolved souls, unmindful of the fact that the lowliest canine possesses psychic powers far exceeding their own, but incapable of rationally directing its powers. The animal must live and move and have its being in bondage to man. The psychic who has not through rational discipline become master of these psychic endowments is in no way superior spiritually to the brute, and will ultimately suffer some brutish end for his irrationality. The fond illusion that perfection comes naturally to such people must go if true consciousness is to be attained. The sphere of grace. Herein is revealed the mystery of the universal soul and the redemption of man. Through the doctrine of grace. When atonement is understood in its Platonic interpretation as an at-one-ment, or reconciliation of the not-self and the self through the disciplines of philosophy, we come to sense the magnitude of spiritual redemption. Chapter 7. The Christian theory of redemption is unique in that it emphasizes salvation as attainable in spite of vice rather than because of virtue. In fact, the prime saving virtue for the Christian is acceptance of the divinity of Jesus Christ. That a viewpoint so philosophically unsound could have gained so firm a foothold in the number and power of its adherents is more than passing strange. The early Christian theologians condemned nearly every normal attitude of mankind, advocating extreme practices and austerities that have produced a full measure of religious neurotics and worse. Regarded as sanctified souls, these abnormals engrafted upon the main body of their faith attitudes and disciplines which, being the products of irrationality, only added to the general confusion. It is philosophically inconceivable. For example, that deity should advocate flagellation as a means by which the flesh could be mortified into a state of piety. Nor has any utilitarian value, divine or human, yet been demonstrated to result from sitting like St. Simeon Stylites for 30 years upon the top of a pillar 60 feet in the air. It is a theory, ingenious but unconvincing, that to be born was a disaster because of the indiscretions of our first parents, that to live was a crime to be expiated only by living miserably, and that to die was simply a transition by which the members of the church militant were reborn into the choirs of the church triumphant. For the individual living in the cosmopolitan religious atmosphere of North America, it is difficult to realize the influence wielded by theology over the devout in those countries where religion still dominates almost every phase of individual and the doctrine of redemption through grace. 145. 146 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Community Life. Out of such a theological autocracy have risen organizations differing widely in attitudes and standards. On the one hand we find the Misericordia, whose hooded MEM bears often men of distinction and culture unhesitatingly serve the needy of every class in the hour of plague or disaster. On the other hand we find the Ignorantin friars, men of sincere motive but benighted vision who boast of their illiteracy and consider a knowledge of even the fundamental principles of life as detrimental to the plan of salvation. While not actually requiring austerity of some kind, several great world religions openly encourage the practice among the MEM bears of their various orders. Even today most people view with a marked reverence one who has made of his physical body a broken and emaciated sacrifice in the effort to atone for his participation in humanity's heritage of sin. The God of joy is dead, and in his stead rules the God of tears. Man, unillumined, cannot achieve tranquility. He struggles impotently against a universe which, to his myopic vision, seems bent on his annihilation but which is really molding him into a future God. In his ignorance of the plan the suffering human creature conceives all being to be ruled by the scepter of sorrow. In that supreme dramatic achievement, Lazarus laughed. Eugene O'Neill enunciates the gospel of joy, a gospel which must someday supplant grief-stricken theology and lead man from the worship of death to the worship of life. Lazarus is made to say, man's loneliness is but his fear of life. Lonely. No more. Millions of laughing stars there are around me. And laughing dust, born once of woman on this earth, now freed to dance. New stars are born of dust eternally. The old, grown mellow with God, burst into flaming seed. The fields of infinite space are sown and grass for sheep springs. Up on the hills of earth. But there is no death, nor fear, nor loneliness I. There is only God's eternal laughter. His laughter flows into the lonely heart. Springing up during the decline of classical pagandom, Christianity felt itself divinely called to save the world from the insufficiency of previous doctrines. Witnessing with holy horror what it termed the perversions of the barbarians, the Church finally arrogated to itself the office of sole mediator between the spirit of righteousness on the one hand and a wayward world on the other. Arbitrarily seating itself in the chief place, with one imperious gesture it dissolved the body religious, consigning all previous knowledge and beliefs of man into the limbo of decadent cults. Discovering that, like man, no faith can live by itself alone, Christianity was later forced to borrow from the pagans the very fundamental principles upon which its own philosophy is erected. It accordingly accepted the concept of heaven and hell as disseminated by the Egyptians and Greeks, but changed the personnel of the doorkeepers. The angelic hierarchies with which the Jews populated the celestial spheres were appropriated en masse and thereupon ceased their Hebrew chants to sing hymns in ecclesiastical Latin. With one fell swoop, Christendom thus became master of all the spheres which the enraptured vision of pagan cosmologists had perceived. The Church not only sought to stamp out heathenism from the earth but, invading even the uttermost parts of the invisible universe, drove the illustrious souls of pagandom from their own heavens and hells to make room for the proselytes of Christianity. In its religious philosophy, Christianity was thus truly eclectic, placing its mark of approval on isolated fragments of thought in such a haphazard manner that it is now impossible to find any thread of consistency which will bind the whole together. Hence, its articles of faith must be considered individually except in the few isolated cases where a common denominator is present. According to the Churchman, this weight of disagreement is not to be regarded as detracting from the sanctity or validity of the articles, since each is the direct revelation of a deity who revealed what he wanted to when it pleased him, and whose reasons therefore transcended human estimation. Whatever profundity is found in Christian philosophy is due primarily to this infusion of pagan ideas. Conversely, the shallowness of Christianity is the direct result of the clumsy efforts made to improve upon the ancient doctrines.